man. This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks.
The Lord is with you. You know, ever since I moved back to Edmonton, I've never really understood the weird Calgary-Edmonton rivalry that's always going on. There's always a bad joke just at the ready about one city or the other. And, I mean, of course, people from Calgary live in a soulless husk of a city. It does serve as an off-ramp for multinational oil barons as they head off to Venezuela or Saudi Arabia or the Arctic ice shelf, I guess, but maybe we should be a little nicer to Calgary, I think. Of course, if you're from Calgary, welcome to Edmonton, the industrial oil stain in the middle of a cold prairie, a habitat for jacked up pickup trucks, otherwise known as Deadmonton. It's a little weird, isn't it? Especially if both teams don't make the playoffs. Maybe we should just call a truce and meet somewhere in Red Deer and bury the hatchet, and we'll just pick on them forever. Red Deer. No more Calgary jokes, just, okay. It's weird, isn't it? How we, as human beings, for as long as we've been around, we can so quickly crack some jokes, pick on a place, maybe a neighborhood or a city. And it doesn't take very long before those jokes, in a really subtle and terrible way, can write off a whole place or a people. And it can turn especially dangerous when that bit of good humor turns into something mean. Really gross. And even worse, sometimes we turn it on ourselves. We point that savage wit at our own histories, our own lives. And we reveal our prejudices. We reveal our fears. And we reveal our own cynicism. Cynicism, of course, is one of the toxic byproducts of pretty much any civilization. It's that place where the insight about the worst of us sabotages our very best efforts. You can name an idea or a philosophy or an ism. You can point to someone's dream, someone's project, a system or an organization, and you will always be able to find a cluster of disappointed idealists, otherwise known as cynics, with their coffee cups in hand and their eyebrows cocked just so, telling it like it is. And these people can point out with just deadly precision the way that system or idea or project has failed us all. The sad part is that given enough time, a cynic can move all the way to glib or sarcastic. Maybe you don't even use names like cynicism and nihilism or narcissism. Whatever you want to call it, I think it's clear that a lot of us suffer from a whole bunch of varieties of modern life sickness. So many ways of being made little. So many ways to reduce the richness and beauty of human experience to a cheap joke. Or a string of numbers, or an assortment of chemicals in our bloodstream, or a leisure activity. We are people besieged by so many of these forces, and we live these realities every day. What shape does our disappointment take? In the face of all of these realities, what can and what should our response look like? Here at First Baptist Church, we are embarking, along with the rest of the human race, on another journey around the sun. And maybe you're asking yourself here in 2018, why should I keep giving my time and my energy and my resources to a place of worship like this one? And maybe you can't quite put your finger on it. Why do you give your time and your energy to a place of worship like this one? Why even bother? Maybe you could name a bunch of reasons. And that's why we gave you this pink slip. You might want to write a little note for the other saints around you to hear that we can share at another time. Why I gather with this community of faith. A big part of it, I think, is because we, all of us, really do need help along the way. We gather and we worship together because we need doses of awe. We need doses of wonder. We need reassurances. We hear encouraging words all around us. We hear those words in the voices of the bodies of the people gathered with us every Sunday. We need these living blessings in our brothers and sisters to inoculate us against the snarky quip makers and the explainers. We need deep truths to combat the thin lies of our age. We need reminders that fragile beauty is deeply valuable, even while we ourselves and everyone around us is constantly weighed and measured and sized up as an asset, a resource, a commodity, or a market. Today's gospel story is a story about people finding Jesus. Or maybe it's a story about Jesus finding people, however you'd like to frame it. We catch up with Philip, who's excited to share some truly mind-blowing news. And so he goes looking for his friend Nathanael. He says to him, "We have found the one about whom Moses in the law and also the prophets wrote, Jesus, son of Joseph from Nazareth." The question is, how many messiahs had Nathanael already heard about at this point in his life? How many of them had he maybe signed up for the newsletter and gave a donation to? Did he go to a meeting of zealots who were carrying angry little knives? Did he join or think about joining a group of monkish Essenes out in the desert performing purification rituals and waiting for the day of the Lord? Or maybe he just joined another branch of Judaism we've never heard of, claiming to have found a way to purify the land and its people. Considering his troubled landscape and his historical context, Nathanael lived in an occupied nation, boiling with unrest and anger, a religious pressure cooker full of disappointed and frustrated people. It's not hard to see when Nathanael has a sick burn at the ready to lay on the latest messianic challenger. A cynical response to yet another claim. Oh, really? Messiah? Who hails from a laughable punchline of a town called Nazareth? In my experience, most cynics actually believe that they've earned the right to be cynical. It's interesting that Philip starts with a chapter and verse explanation for who Jesus is. Maybe he knows that Nathanael is the sort of guy who reads Consumer Reports before he buys a blender, or he investigates and researches every one of the political candidates before he votes. He knows his Bible verses and how to use them. Nathanael protects himself with his intellect, with his wit, and maybe a dose of cynicism, maybe a dose of disillusionment. He's a tough nut to crack. He's a hard thinker. But after that bit about Moses and the prophets and the writings, Philip tells Nathanael that this amazing guy, this promised one, is Jesus, son of Joseph from Nazareth. About as generic a name as you can get, an unimpressive nobody of a dad, that joke of a town called Nazareth on the way to no place. Funny thing is, Nazareth, Nathanael, was from Cana. It's in the same province, but it's only 10 miles away. Maybe their volleyball teams had a rivalry, and maybe there's some sort of West Side Story turf war they used to have where they would fight with switchblades. Really, though, Nazareth just wasn't really much of any place. It was a whole lot of backwater nothing on the way to someplace better. And so he drops the big zinger. Can anything good come out of Nazareth? But don't. He's almost waiting for disciples to laugh and snicker along. In this season of Epiphany, it's the time where we practice being surprised again. Surprised by the fresh and mysterious inbreaking of God's light in the world. This is a season where we remind ourselves to be filled with awe and wonder. We recall those strange and unlikely ways that God chooses to meet us. So it makes sense for us to take a moment to share some of Nathanael's surprise. Maybe snarky surprise even, considering that the one about whom Moses wrote in the law and about whom the prophets wrote to would come in such a spectacularly unspectacular way. They don't know it yet, but these disciples are bearing witness to the germination of the church's first seeds. Seeds that are going to grow into that messy garden that we call a church. In the last 2,000 years, what a messy garden it has become. Thorny scandals and conflicts. Sure, we have grown some beautiful flowers, but we have also embarrassed ourselves with some spectacular stinkers. If you talk to almost anyone about the church, easy punchlines abound. Jokes about entitled and thin-skinned, pick-and-choose Bible reading, bigots, homophobes, corrupt, organized religion. These people who have a baffling resistance to science, and they continue to believe such strange magic stories. Jokes are almost too easy, aren't they? And really, as people in the church, we might not like this broad brush right off of our life of faith. And yet we can't deny that we have earned some of the reputation. In 2018, you could almost hear someone ask, can anything good come from the institutional church? Can anything good from a place that still calls itself Baptist, of all things, in the year 2018? Here's the thing. Jesus sees past all of it. He sees past our frustration. He sees past our disappointment. He sees past our abundant failings. He sees it all. Jesus saw Nathanael coming toward him, and he says about him, look, really, an Israelite in whom there is nothing phony. Nathanael says to him, how do you know me? Jesus thought and said to him, before Philip even invited you here, while you were still sitting under the fig tree, I saw you. Now, we don't know what Nathanael was up to under that fig tree. Was he sitting in meditation? Was he touching the earth and pondering the universe? Or maybe he was just really angry, frustrated, asking God what he should do with his life. Maybe he was daydreaming. Whatever the case, Nathanael's preconceived notions, his intellectual bias, all of his coping mechanisms dissolve away in an instant when he met a living Jesus. The Jesus who knew just what a sort of guy Nathanael was. The living Christ who saw past his easy jokes. The living Christ who saw him. Over the years, a lot of biblical scholars and experts have tried to tie some sort of significance to that fig tree. And there's good reason to think that. The fig tree shows up an awful lot in the Bible. Sometimes it's a symbol for the nation of Israel or the law of Israel. Sometimes fig trees were places where rabbis thought or studied or gathered their disciples. For some people, a fig tree was a symbol of messianic peace. Actually, you can read a really long list of the speculation about what that fig tree meant, but really, it's all just speculation. Because whatever it was that Nathanael was doing under that fig tree, and whatever that's supposed to mean, whatever private story that only he and Jesus knew, that tree just happened to be the place where he found himself, the place where Jesus saw him. And so that fig tree stands as sort of landmark, sitting in for all sorts of other landmarks. Landmarks that dot the globe, and they look like open fields, freeways, beaches and forests, mountains and living rooms, prison cells. Locations where people from all sorts of places with all kinds of stories found themselves wondering or pondering, angry or disappointed or frustrated. And that was the place where their story, where their before Jesus story meets their after Jesus story. This same Christ sees us, knows us. That is, Jesus wants us to see what he sees when he looks at us. He sees our living possibilities. He knows that the sum of our disappointments and our struggles, our cynicism and our failures can't take away the inherent value born in each of us, all of us. This was how the church was made on its very first days when there was just a handful of people. And this is how the church gets remade every single day. Not because of crafty techniques or some sort of spectacular strategy or even one of the best choirs ever, am I right? The church is a gathering of people amazed by this living Christ. People who can't wait to join their voices with Philip the evangelist. Can anything good come from a place like this? Is this Jesus of any concern to someone like me? Does the living God enliven and live in and speak to a people like this? Please. And really, all any of us can say is come and see. Amen.